History's Book 9, Calliope. Mardonius, once Alexander had returned and reported to him what the Athenians had said, set out from Thessaly and led his army in haste against Athens. Wherever he came, he took up the men of that place along with him. The rulers of Thessaly felt no regret at all for what they had done before, but urged the Persian on all the more. Indeed, Thorax of Larissa had escorted Xerxes on his flight, and now openly sent Mardonius on his way against Greece. When the army on its march reached Boeotia, the Thebans tried to detain Mardonius and advised him, saying that there was no place better suited for encamping than theirs, and urged him not to go any farther, but to settle there and see to it that he subdued all of Greece without a battle. For as long as the Greeks stood united in strength, as they had done before, it would be hard, they said, for all mankind together to overcome them. But if you do as we advise, they said, you will have, without effort, all their strongest plans. Send money to the men who hold power in the cities. By sending it, you will split Greece apart, and from then on, with the aid of your partisans, you will easily subdue those who do not think as you wish. This was their advice, but he would not be persuaded. Instead, a terrible longing had settled in him to take Athens a second time, partly out of stubbornness, and partly because he thought to signal to the king, who was at Sardis, by means of beacon fires across the islands, that he held Athens. But when he arrived in Attica this time too, he did not find the Athenians there. He learned that most of them were at Salamis and in the ships, and he took the city empty of people. The king's capture of Athens and this later expedition of Mardonius's were 10 months apart. When Mardonius was in Athens, he sent to Salamis a man of the Hellespont named Murichides, carrying the same message that Alexander the Macedonian had conveyed to the Athenians. He sent this a second time, though he well knew the Athenians' feelings were not friendly, in hopes that they would give way in their stubbornness, now that Attica lay conquered by the spear and in his hands. For this reason, he sent Murichides to Salamis. When he arrived before the council, he delivered Mardonius's message. Of the counselors, Lycidas gave his opinion that it seemed better to accept the proposal Murichides was putting to them and bring it before the assembly of the people. This opinion he declared, whether because he had taken money from Mardonius or because this was truly his own view. But the Athenians, council members and outsiders alike, were filled with fury the moment they learned of it, and surrounding Lycidas they stoned him to death, but sent Murichides the Hellespontine away unharmed. When the uproar over Lycidas arose in Salamis, the wives of the Athenians learned what was happening, and one woman urging another, and taking others with her. And together, they made their way unbidden to Lycidas's house, and stoned his wife and his children as well. Now this is how the Athenians had crossed over to Salamis. As long as they still hoped that a Peloponnesian army would arrive to defend them, they stayed put in Attica. But when the Peloponnesians kept delaying and dragging their feet, and the enemy was advancing and was already said to be in Boeotia, then they moved everything out and crossed over themselves to Salamis, and sent messengers to Laestemon, partly to reproach the Lacedaemonians for having allowed the barbarian to invade Attica instead of meeting him together with the Athenians in Boeotia, and partly to remind them of what the Persian had promised to give them if they changed sides, and to warn that if they did not come to the Athenians' aid, the Athenians too would find some way to save themselves. For the Lacedaemonians at that time were holding festival, keeping the Hyacinthia, and set the greatest importance on attending to the rites of the god. And at the same time, the wall they were building across the isthmus was already being fitted with battlements. When the messengers arrived at Laestemon, the ones from Athens, bringing with them also messengers from Megara and from Plataea, they came before the ephors and spoke as follows. When the ephors heard this, they put off giving an answer until the next day, and on the next day until the day after. This they did for 10 days running, putting it off from day to day. Meanwhile, all the Peloponnesians were building the wall across the isthmus with great urgency, and it was nearly finished. I cannot say what the reason was that, back when Alexander the Macedonian reached Athens, they had taken great pains that the Athenians should not go over to the Persians, yet now they showed no concern at all, except that the isthmus had by then been walled, and they thought they no longer had any need of the Athenians. Whereas when Alexander came to Attica, the wall was not yet finished, and they were working at it in great fear of the Persians. In the end, the manner of their answer and of the Spartiates setting out was as follows. On the day before the last hearing was to take place, Chilius, a man of Tegea who carried more weight with the Lacedaemonians than any other foreigner, learned from the ephors the whole speech that the Athenians had been making. Having heard it, Chilius said this to them. It stands thus, gentlemen ephors, if the Athenians are not on our side, but instead allies of the barbarian, then, even though a strong wall has been built across the isthmus, wide gates stand open into the Peloponnese for the Persian. Listen to me, before the Athenians decide on some other course that brings ruin upon Greece. This was his advice to them, and they, taking the argument to heart at once, without saying anything to the messengers who had come from the cities, sent out that very night 5,000 Spartiates, assigning 7 helots to each man, with orders that Pausanias son of Cleombrotus should lead them out. The command rightly belonged to Plestarchus son of Leonidas, but he was still a boy, and Pausanias was his guardian and cousin. For Cleombrotus, Pausanias's father and son of Anaxandrides, was no longer living. He had led the army away from the isthmus after it had finished building the wall, and not long after that he died. Cleombrotus led the army away from the isthmus for this reason. While he was sacrificing against the Persian, the sun in the sky grew dark. Pausanias took as his colleague Euryanax son of Dorius, a man of the same house as himself. So these men had set out with Pausanias out of Sparta. But the messengers, when day came, knowing nothing of the departure, went before the ephors, intending each to leave for home, and coming before them they said this, "You Lacedaemonians stay here and celebrate the Hyacinthia and enjoy yourselves, betraying your allies. The Athenians, since they have been wronged by you and lack allies, will make terms with the Persian in whatever way they can. And once we have made terms, for it is plain that we shall then become allies of the king, we shall join his campaign against whatever land he leads us. You will then learn what the outcome of this will be for you." As the messengers said this, the ephors declared on oath that they believed the men were already on the road to Orsthium, marching against the strangers, for strangers was what they called the barbarians. The messengers, not knowing this, asked what was meant, and on inquiring learned the whole truth, so that in astonishment they set out in pursuit as fast as they could, and with them went 5,000 chosen hoplites of the Lacedaemonian periarchy, doing the same thing. These men then hastened toward the isthmus. But the Argives, as soon as they learned that the men under Pausanias had set out from Sparta, sent as herald the best of their day runners to Attica, since they had earlier promised Mardonius that they would prevent the Spartiate from marching out. When he arrived at Athens, he said this, "Mardonius, the Argives have sent me to tell you that the young men have set out from Laestemon, and that Argus lacks the power to stop them from marching out. In light of this, take good counsel." Having said this, he went back the way he came. Mardonius, when he heard this, was no longer at all eager to remain in Attica. Before learning this, he had held back, wishing to know what the Athenians would do, and he neither harmed nor damaged the land of Attica, expecting that the whole time they would come to terms with him. But when he could not persuade them, having learned the whole matter, before the men under Pausanias could invade the isthmus, he withdrew. But first he burned Athens, and whatever was still standing of the walls or the houses or the temples, he threw all of it down and razed it to the ground. He marched away for these reasons. The land of Attica was not suited to cavalry, and if he were defeated in battle, there was no way out except through a tight defile where only a handful of defenders could hold it against him. He therefore resolved to withdraw to Thebes and give battle near a city friendly to him and in country suited to cavalry. So Mardonius withdrew, but while he was already on the road, word came to him that another army, an advance force, had arrived at Megara, 1,000 Lacedaemonians. On learning this, he deliberated, wishing to see if he might somehow catch these men first. He turned his army back and led it against Megara, and his cavalry, going on ahead, overran the land of Megara. This was the farthest point toward the setting sun in Europe that this Persian army ever reached. After this, word came to Mardonius that the Greeks were gathered together at the isthmus, and so he marched back by way of Decelia, for the Boatarch sent for the men of Esopia who lived nearby, and these men guided him on the road to Svendeli, and from there to Tanagra. At Tanagra he spent the night camped, and on the next day, turning toward Scolus, he was in the territory of Thebes. There, although the Thebans had sided with the Medes, he cut down their trees, not out of hatred for them, but under great necessity, to make a fortified camp for his army, and so that, if it came to battle, so that if things did not turn out as he wished, he would have this as a refuge. He extended his camp from Erythrae past Hysiae and stretched it into the land of Plataea, drawn up along the river Asopus. The wall itself, however, he did not make so large, but each face about 10 stadia at most. While the barbarians were occupied with this labor, Atagenus, son of Phrynon, a Theban man, made great preparations and invited to a feast both Mardonius himself and 50 of the most eminent Persians, and being invited, they came. The dinner was held at Thebes. What follows I heard from Thersander, a man of Orchomenus, one of the foremost people there. Thersander said that he too had been invited by Atagenus to this dinner, and that 50 Theban men had also been invited, and that they were not seated apart from each other but a Persian and a Theban together on each couch. When the dinner was over, as they were drinking, the Persian who shared his couch, speaking in Greek, asked him where he was from, and he answered that he was from Orchomenus. The Persian said, "Since you have now become my table companion and drinking companion, I want to leave with you a memorial of my thinking, so that you yourself, forewarned, may be able to plan what is advantageous for you. Do you see these Persians feasting here, and the army we left encamped by the river? Of all these, you will see, when a little time has passed, only a few survivors remaining." As the Persian said this, he shed many tears. He himself, astonished at the speech, said to him, "Should not this be said to Mardonius, and to those among the Persians who are honored next after him?" The Persian then said, "Friend, what is destined to happen from God, a man cannot by any device turn aside, for no one is willing to believe even those who speak the truth. Many of us Persians know this well, yet we follow, bound by necessity, and the bitterest pain among men is this, to know much and have power over nothing. This is what I heard from Thersander of Orchomenus, and this in addition, that he himself told these things to people right away, before the battle at Plataea took place. While Mardonius was encamped in Boeotia, all the rest supplied troops and joined the invasion of Attica, as many of the Greeks living in that region as were on the Persian side, except the Phocians alone, who did not join the invasion, though they too were very much on the Persian side, not willingly, but under compulsion. Not many days after their arrival at Thebes, 1,000 of their hoplites came, led by Harmacides, a man held in the highest esteem among his countrymen. When these two had arrived at Thebes, Mardonius sent horsemen and ordered them to take up a position by themselves in the plain. When they had done this, at once the entire cavalry appeared. After this, a rumor passed through the Greek army that was on the Persian side that the cavalry would spear the Phocians down, and the same rumor passed through the Phocians themselves. Then their general Harmacides exhorted them, speaking as follows, "Phocians, it is plain enough that these men intend to give us over to a foreseen death, slandered as we have been by the Thessalians, as I guess. Now every one of you must prove himself brave. It is better to end one's life doing something and defending oneself than to be destroyed by submitting to the most shameful death. Let each of them learn that, being barbarians, they have plotted murder against Greek men." So he exhorted them, and the horsemen, when they had encircled them, charged as if to destroy them, and indeed drew their bows as if to shoot, and some perhaps did loose an arrow. But the Phocians stood firm on every side, drawing themselves together and closing ranks as tightly as possible. Then the horsemen wheeled about and rode back. I cannot say for certain whether they came intending to destroy the Phocians at the Thessalians' request, but then, seeing them turn to defend themselves, feared that they themselves might suffer losses and so rode back, for this is what Mardonius had ordered them, or whether he wished to test them to see if they had any courage. When the horsemen had ridden back, Mardonius sent a herald and said this, "Take courage, Phocians, you have shown yourselves to be brave men, contrary to what I had been told. Now carry on this war eagerly, for in good service you will not outdo either me or the king." So much for what concerned the Phocians. The Lacedaemonians, when they came to the isthmus, encamped there. Learning of this, the rest of the Peloponnesians whose views were the better ones, and others too seeing the Spartiates marching out, felt it would be wrong to lag behind the Lacedaemonian advance. So then, from the isthmus, once the sacrifices proved favorable, they all marched and arrived at Eleusis. and having performed sacrifices thereto, since these were favorable, they marched onward, and the Athenians together with them, having crossed over from Salamis and joined them at Eleusis. When they arrived at Erythrae in Boeotia, they learned that the barbarians were encamped by the Asopus, and having been informed of this, they drew up opposite them on the lower slopes of Cithaeron. Mardonius, since the Greeks were not coming down into the plain, sent against them the whole of his cavalry, commanded by Masistius, a man held in high repute among the Persians, whom the Greeks call Masistius, riding a Nisaean horse with a golden bit and otherwise splendidly adorned. When the horsemen rode up against the Greeks, they attacked by squadrons, and in attacking did great harm and called them women. By chance, the Megareans happened to be stationed at the point that was most exposed to attack in the whole position, and it was there that the cavalry could approach most easily. As the cavalry attacked, the Megareans, hard-pressed, sent a herald to the generals of the Greeks, and when the herald arrived before them, he said this: "The Megareans say, 'We allied men are not able to withstand the Persian cavalry alone, holding the position we have taken up from the start. Yet even so, up to now we have held out by persistence and courage, hard-pressed though we are. Now, unless you send some others to relieve us in this position, be assured we will abandon it.' So he reported this to them, and Pausanias sounded out the Greeks to see if any others were willing to volunteer to go to that place and take up the position in relief of the Megareans. As the others were unwilling, the Athenians undertook it, and among the Athenians the 300 picked men, whose company Olympiodorus son of Lampon commanded. These were the ones who undertook the task, and who, ahead of the rest of the Greeks present, were stationed toward Erythrae, having taken the archers along with them. As they fought for a time, the battle came at last to the following outcome. As the cavalry attacked by squadrons, Masistius's horse, being out in front of the others, was struck by an arrow in the flank, and in pain it reared up and threw off Masistius, and as he fell the Athenians immediately set upon him. They seized his horse and killed the man himself as he defended himself, though at first they were unable to, for he was armored thus. He wore beneath a golden scaled breastplate, and over the breastplate he had put on a crimson tunic. As they struck against the breastplate, they accomplished nothing, until someone, realizing what was happening, struck him in the eye. Thus he fell and died. Somehow all this happened without the notice of the other horsemen, for they neither saw him fall from his horse nor saw him die, since it happened as they were wheeling and turning back, and so they did not perceive what had happened. But when they halted, at once they missed him, since there was no one to give them orders. And realizing what had happened, they urged one another on and rode their horses forward all together, so as to recover the corpse. Seeing the horsemen no longer attacking by squadrons, but all at once, the Athenians called out to the rest of the army for help. While all the infantry was coming to their aid, a fierce battle over the corpse took place. As long as the 300 were alone, they were getting much the worse of it and were abandoning the corpse. But when the main body came to their aid, then the horsemen no longer held their ground, nor were they able to carry off the corpse. But in addition to Masistius, they lost still more of their horsemen. Withdrawing about 2 stadia, they deliberated what they ought to do, and since they had no commander, riding back to Mardonius seemed the best course. When the cavalry arrived back at the camp, the whole army and Mardonius above all made the greatest mourning for Masistius, cropping their own hair and the manes of their horses and pack animals, and giving themselves over to unbounded wailing. For all Boeotia rang with the sound, since a man had died who was the most esteemed among the Persians and with the king, next after Mardonius. So the barbarians, in their own fashion, honored Masistius in death. As for the Greeks, once they had withstood the cavalry's attack, and having withstood it, driven it back, they took much greater courage, and first placing the corpse on a wagon, they carried it along their ranks. And the corpse was worth seeing for its size and beauty, and it was for this reason that they did this. Leaving their ranks, men came flocking to look at Masistius. After this, it seemed best to them to go down to Plataea, for the Plataean ground appeared to them far more suitable for encamping than that of Erythrae, both in other respects, and because it had better water. They decided it was necessary to go to this place, and to the spring called Gargaphia, which was in this district, and to encamp there in their assigned positions. Taking up their arms, they went along the lower slopes of Cithaeron, past Hysiae, into the land of Plataea. And having arrived, they drew up by nations close to the Gargaphia Spring and the sacred grove of the hero Androcrates, over ground of low hills and level land. There, in the arranging of positions, a great dispute of words arose between the Tegeans and the Athenians, for each of the two claimed the right to hold the one wing, bringing up examples both new and old. The Tegeans spoke first, saying this, "We have always been deemed worthy of this position by all the allies, in every joint campaign the Peloponnesians have ever undertaken, both in old times and new, ever since the Heraclidae, after the death of Eurystheus, tried to come back down into the Peloponnese. It was then that we won this honor, through the following affair. When we marched out to the aid of the Achaeans and Ionians, who then lived in the Peloponnese, and took our stand at the isthmus opposite those coming down against us, the story goes that Hyllus proclaimed that it was not right for army to risk battle against army, but that whoever the Peloponnesians judged to be their best man should fight him in single combat on agreed terms. The Peloponnesians resolved that this should be done and swore an oath to this effect. If Hyllus should defeat the champion of the Peloponnesians, the Heraclidae were to return to their ancestral lands. But if he were defeated, the Heraclidae were to withdraw instead, lead their army away, and for 100 years make no attempt to return to the Peloponnese. From all the allies there was chosen, as a volunteer, Echemus son of Aeropus son of Phegeus, who was both our general and our king, and he fought the single combat and killed Hyllus. As a result of this deed, we won, among the Peloponnesians of that time, other great privileges as well, which we have continued to hold ever since, and in particular the right always to command one of the two wings whenever a joint expedition takes place. To you, Lacedaemonians, we make no objection. We leave you the choice of which wing you wish to command, and yield it to you. But the other wing we say belongs to us to command, as in time past. And apart from this deed we have related, we are more deserving than the Athenians of holding this position. Many contests, men of Sparta, have we fought against you and won honorably, and many against others as well. It is therefore just that we, and not the Athenians, should hold the second wing, for they have no such deeds to their credit as we do, neither new nor old." So the Tegeans spoke, and the Athenians replied to this as follows. "We understand that this gathering was assembled for battle against the barbarian, not for speeches. But since the man of Tegea has proposed to speak of the good deeds, old and new, that each side has accomplished in all time, we are obliged to make clear to you the grounds on which it is our inheritance to be first always, being men of merit, rather than the Arcadians. As for the Heraclidae, whose leader these men claim to have killed at the isthmus, these very men, when they were being driven out earlier by all the Greeks to whom they fled to escape enslavement by the Mycenaeans, we alone took in and put down the arrogance of Eurystheus, fighting alongside them and defeating in battle those who then held the Peloponnese. And as for the Argives who marched with Polynices against Thebes and having died, lay unburied, we campaigned against the Cadmeans, recovered the bodies, and buried them in our own land at Eleusis. We also have a fine deed to our credit concerning the Amazons, who once invaded the land of Attica after crossing over from the Thermodon, and in the hardships of the Trojan War, we ranked behind no one. But there is no advantage in dwelling on these things, for those who were good men then might well be worse now, and those who were poor men then might well be better now. Let old deeds be enough, then. But even if we had no other achievement to point to, though in fact we have many, and good ones, as many as any other Greeks, still, on the strength of our deed at Marathon alone, we deserve to hold this honor, and more besides. We who alone of the Greeks fought the Persian in single combat, and undertook so great a deed, and survived, and defeated 46 nations. Are we not entitled to hold this position on the strength of this deed alone? But since it is not fitting to quarrel over position at a time like this, we are ready to obey you, Lacedaemonians, as to wherever you think it best for us to stand, and against whichever troops. Wherever we are stationed, we shall try to prove ourselves good men. Only give the order, and we shall obey." This was their answer, and at it the whole Lacedaemonian army shouted out that the Athenians were more deserving of holding the wing than the Arcadians. So the Athenians won it, and prevailed over the Tegeans. After this, the Greeks were arrayed in the following order, both those who had come from the start and those who joined later. The right wing was manned by 10,000 men of Lacedaemon. Of these, the 5,000 who were Spartiates were guarded by 35,000 light-armed helots, 7 assigned to each man. The Spartans chose to have the Tegeans stand next to them, both for honor's sake and for their valor. These numbered 1,500 hoplites. After these stood 5,000 Corinthians, and next to them, by arrangement with Pausanias, stood the 300 men of Potidaea from Pallene who were present. Next to these stood 600 Arcadians of Orchomenus, and next to them, 3,000 Sicyonians. Next to these came 800 Epidaurians. Beside them were arrayed 1,000 Trozenians, and next to the Trozenians, 200 men of Leprium, and next to these 400 Mycenaeans and Tirinthians, and next to these 1,000 Phlyasians. Beside these stood 300 men of Hermione. Next to the Hermionians stood 600 Eretrians and Styrians, and next to these 400 Chalcidians, and next to these 500 Ampraciates. Following them came 800 men from Leucas and Anactorium, and beside those stood 200 Pelians from Cephallenia. After these were stationed 500 Aeginetans. Beside them were arrayed 3,000 Megareans. Next to these stood 600 Plataeans. Last, though also first, were arrayed the Athenians, holding the left wing, 8,000 strong, commanded by Aristides, son of Lysimachus. All these, apart from the 7 light-armed men assigned to each Spartiate, were hoplites, numbering in all 38,700. This was the total number of hoplites gathered against the barbarian. As for the light-armed troops, their number was as follows. Of the Spartan contingent, there were 35,000 men, since 7 were assigned to each man, and every one of these was equipped for war. Among the remaining Lacedaemonians and other Greeks, the light troops, 1 per man, came to 34,500. So the total number of all the light-armed fighting men was 69,500, and the whole Greek force that assembled at Plataea, hoplites and light-armed fighting men together, numbered 110,000, lacking 800 men. This number of 110,000 was made complete by the Thespians who were present, for there were also survivors of the Thespians in the camp, numbering 1,800, but these had no arms. Such then was the force arrayed and encamped along the Esopus. As for Mardonius and his barbarians, once they had finished mourning Masistius, they came, on learning that the Greeks were at Plataea, to the Esopus that flows past there. On arriving, they were arrayed by Mardonius as follows, facing them. Facing the Lacedaemonians, he placed the Persians. And since the Persians greatly outnumbered them, far outnumbered the Lacedaemonians, they were drawn up several ranks deep, extending also to face the Tegeans. He arrayed them in this way. Whatever was the strongest and best among the Persians, he picked out and stationed opposite the Lacedaemonians, while the weaker troops he arrayed opposite the Tegeans. He did this on the advice and instruction of the Thebans. Next to the Persians, he stationed the Medes. These faced the Corinthians, the Potidaeans, the Orchomenians, and the Sicyonians. Next to the Medes, he stationed the Bactrians. These faced the Epidaurians, the Trozenians, the men of Leprium, the Tirinthians, the Mycenaeans, and the Phlyasians. Beyond the Bactrians came the Indians, whom he placed facing the Hermionians, the Eretrians, the Styrians, and the Chalcidians. Next to the Indians, he stationed the Sacchi, who faced the Ampraciates, the Anactorians, the Leucadians, the Pelians, and the Aeginetans. Next to the Sacchi, facing the Athenians, the Plataeans, and the Megareans, he stationed the Boeotians, the Locrians, the Malians, the Thessalians, and the 1,000 Phocians. For not all the Phocians had Medized, but some of them supported the Greek cause, having taken refuge around Parnassus, and setting out from there they harried and raided Mardonius' army and those Greeks who were with him. He also stationed the Macedonians and the peoples living around Thessaly opposite the Athenians. These are the greatest of the nations arrayed by Mardonius that have been named, the most notable and most spoken of. But there were also men of other nations mixed in among them, Phrygians and Thracians and Mysians and Paeonians and the rest, and among them also Ethiopians and Egyptians, both the class called Hermotybes and the Calisaires, sword-bearers, who are the only fighting men among the Egyptians. These he had disembarked from the ships while still at Phalerum, for they had served as marines. The Egyptians were not assigned to the infantry that came with Xerxes to Athens. So the barbarian forces numbered 300,000, as has already been shown. But of the Greeks who were allies of Mardonius, no one knows the number, for they were never counted. By conjecture, however, I guess they amounted to about 50,000 gathered together. These were the infantry drawn up in battle order. The cavalry was arrayed separately. When all had been arrayed according to their nations and their units, on the next day, both sides offered sacrifice. For the Greeks, the one who performed the sacrifice was Tisamenes, son of Antiochus, for it was he who accompanied this army as its seer. He was an Elean of the clan of the Iamidi, of the Clytiadi, and the Lacedaemonians had made him a citizen of their own. For when Tisamenes consulted the oracle at Delphi about offspring, the Pythia declared that he would win the five greatest contests. He, misunderstanding the oracle, took up athletic training, thinking he would win contests in the games, and while training he missed winning the Olympic crown in the pentathlon by a single wrestling fall when he competed against Hieronymus of Andros. The Spartans, learning that his gift of prophecy was directed not toward athletic contests, but toward the contests of war, tried to persuade Tisamenes for a fee to become, alongside the Heraclid kings, a leader in their wars. He saw how eager the Spartiates were to win him as a friend, and once he understood this, he raised his price, signaling to them that if they made him their fellow citizen, giving him a share in everything, he would do it, but for no other payment. The Spartiates at first, on hearing this, were outraged and dropped the matter of the oracle entirely. But in the end, with the great fear of this Persian invasion hanging over them, they went back to him and agreed. But he, noticing the shift in their mood, said even so he was no longer satisfied with these terms alone, but that his brother Hedges too must become a Spartiate on the same terms as he himself was becoming one. In saying this, he was imitating Melampus, if one may compare a man asking for citizenship and one asking for kingship. For indeed Melampus too, when the women of Argos went mad, and the Argives tried to hire him from Pylos to cure their women of the disease, set as his price half of the kingship. The Argives could not bear this and left, but as more and more of the women went mad, they came back prepared to give him what Melampus had demanded. He then, seeing them turned around, reached for still more, declaring that unless they also gave a third of the kingship to his brother Bias, he would not do what they wanted. The Argives, driven into a corner, agreed to this as well. So too the Spartiates, since they needed Tisamenes desperately, gave in to him on every point. And once the Spartiates had conceded this too, Tisamenes the Elean, having become a Spartiate, went on to help them win, by his prophecy, five of the greatest contests. These men alone of all mankind ever became citizens of Sparta. The five contests were these. The first and earliest was the one at Plataea, next the one at Tegea against the Tegeans and Argives, after that the one at Dipia against all the Arcadians except the Mantineans, then the one against the Messenians at Ithome, and last the clash at Tanagra, fought against the Athenians and the Argives. This last was the final one accomplished of the five contests. It was this same Tisamenes, who at that time, with the Spartiates leading, gave prophecy for the Greeks at Plataea. For the Greeks, the sacrifices came out favorable so long as they stood on the defensive, but not if they crossed the Esopus and opened battle. For Mardonius, eager to open battle, the sacrifices likewise came out unfavorable, but favorable if he too stood on the defensive. For he too used Greek rites of divination, having as his seer Hegesostratus, a man of Elis and the most eminent of the Telead clan, whom the Spartans had earlier seized and bound, intending to put him to death for the many terrible wrongs he had done them. Caught in this desperate situation, running for his life and facing much cruel suffering before his death, he did a deed greater than words can tell. For as he lay bound in a stocks of iron-bound wood, a piece of iron happened to be brought in, and he got hold of it. At once he devised the most courageous deed of any we know of. Calculating how the rest of his foot could be got free, he cut off his own instep. Having done this, since he was under guard, he dug through the wall and escaped to Tegea, traveling by night and by day hiding in the woods and lodging there. So that although the Lacedaemonians searched for him in full force, by the third night he had reached Tegea, while they were struck with great amazement at his daring, seeing the severed half of his foot lying there yet unable to find him. Having thus escaped the Lacedaemonians at that time, he took refuge in Tegea, which was not on friendly terms with the Lacedaemonians at that period. Once healed and fitted with a wooden foot, he set himself up as an open enemy of the Lacedaemonians. Yet in the end, his hatred toward the Lacedaemonians did not turn out well for him. He was caught prophesying in Zacynthus and put to death by them. His death, however, came after the events at Plataea. At the time in question, hired by Mardonius at no small price on the Esopus, he was sacrificing and showing great zeal both out of his hatred for the Lacedaemonians and for the sake of the pay. When the sacrifices would not come out favorable for battle either for the Persians themselves or for the Greeks who were with them, for these two had their own seer, Hippomachus of Leucas. And as the Greeks kept streaming in and growing more numerous, Timagenetes, son of Herpes, a Theban, advised Mardonius to guard the passes of Cithaeron, saying that the Greeks kept streaming in every day and that he would cut off many of them. They had already been encamped facing each other for 8 days when Timagenetes gave Mardonius this advice. He, recognizing that the counsel was sound, when night came sent his cavalry to the passes of Cithaeron that lead down toward Plataea, which the Boeotians call the Three Heads and the Athenians call Oak Heads. The horsemen who were sent did not go in vain. They caught, as it was coming down into the plain, 500 pack animals bringing provisions from the Peloponnese to the camp, along with the men who were following the wagons. Having taken this catch, the Persians slaughtered it without mercy, sparing neither pack animal nor man. When they had had their fill of killing, they rounded up what was left and drove it to Mardonius and to the camp. After this action, they let 2 more days pass, neither side wishing to open battle. The barbarians advanced as far as the Esopus to test the Greeks, but neither side crossed it. Mardonius' cavalry, however, kept pressing and harassing the Greeks continually. For the Thebans, being wholeheartedly on the Persian side, carried on the war eagerly and always led the way up to the point of battle. And from there, the Persians and Medes took over, and it was they who performed the feats of valor. For the first 10 days, nothing more than this took place. But when the 11th day had come with the two sides still encamped facing each other at Plataea, and the Greeks had grown far more numerous while Mardonius chafed at the delay, then Mardonius son of Gobryas and Artabazus son of Pharnaces, who was among the few Persians held in esteem by Xerxes, came together in council. Their views and deliberation were as follows. Artabazus' opinion was that it would be best to break camp at once and lead the whole army to the walled town of the Thebans, where much grain and pack animal fodder had already been stored up for them, and there settle down quietly and finish matters by doing the following. They possessed vast quantities of gold, both stamped coin and unworked metal, along with great stores of silver and drinking vessels. Sparing none of these, they should distribute them among the Greeks, and especially among the leading men in the various cities, and these would quickly hand over their freedom to them. There was no need to risk battle. This opinion agreed with that of the Thebans too, as though Artabazus had some foreknowledge beyond the rest. But Mardonius' opinion was more forceful and stubborn, and would admit of no concession. He held that their own army was far superior to that of the Greeks, and that they should join battle as soon as possible, and not allow still more Greeks to gather beyond those already assembled, and that they should disregard the sacrifices of Hegesistratus and not force the issue on them, but engage in battle following the custom of the Persians. Since he argued this so decisively, no one spoke against him, so that his opinion prevailed. For command of the army lay with him, by the king's authority, not with Artabazus. Having summoned then that he questioned the division commanders, and among the Greeks serving under him, their generals, asking whether they knew of any oracle concerning the Persians, that they would be destroyed in Greece. When those called upon fell silent, some not knowing the oracles, others knowing them but not thinking it safe to speak, Mardonius himself said, "Since, then, you either know nothing or dare not speak, then let me be the one to tell you, for I know it well. There is an oracle that the Persians are fated, once they come to Greece, to plunder the sanctuary at Delphi, and that after the plundering all of them are to perish. We then, knowing this very thing, will neither go against that sanctuary nor attempt to plunder it, and for that reason we shall not perish. So then, as many of you as happen to be well disposed toward the Persians, rejoice on this account, that we shall prevail over the Greeks." Having said this to them, he next gave orders that everything be made ready and put in good order, since battle would take place at daybreak the following day. As for this oracle, which Mardonius said applied to the Persians, I myself know it to have been composed concerning the Illyrians and the army of the Enchelians, not concerning the Persians. But there are other verses composed by Bassus about this very battle. By the Thermodon and grassy Esopus, the gathering of the Greeks and the barbarous cry, where many will fall beyond their allotted fate and the doom of the bow-bearing Medes, when the fated day comes upon them. This and other similar verses I know Musaeus composed concerning the Persians. As for the river Thermodon, it runs its course between Tanagra and Glises. After the questioning about the oracles and the exhortation from Mardonius, night came on and the men were posted to their watches. When the night was far advanced and quiet seemed to have settled over the camps, and most of all the men appeared to be asleep, at that hour Alexander, son of Amyntas, general and king of the Macedonians, rode up to the Athenian sentries and asked to speak with their generals. Most of the sentries stayed at their posts, but some ran to the generals, and coming to them, said that a man had arrived on horseback from the camp of the Medes, who would reveal nothing else but, naming the generals, said he wished to speak with them. When they heard this, they at once followed to the sentry posts. When they had come, Alexander said this, "Men of Athens, I am placing these words with you as a deposit, asking that you keep them secret and tell no one but Pausanias, so that you do not ruin me too. For I would not speak them if my concern for the whole of Greece were not so deep. I myself am a Greek by ancient descent, and I would not want to see Greece enslaved instead of free. I tell you then that the sacrificial victims cannot come out favorably for Mardonius and his army, for otherwise you would have fought long ago. But now he has decided to let the omens be and to bring on the engagement as soon as day breaks. For he is afraid, as I guess, that you will gather in still greater numbers. So prepare yourselves accordingly. And if Mardonius should put off the engagement and not bring it on, hold your ground and wait, for only a few days' provisions remain to them. And if this war ends according to your wish, someone ought to remember me too, with a view to my freedom, I who, out of zeal on the Greeks' behalf, have carried out so hazardous a deed, wishing to reveal to you Mardonius's intention, so as to keep the barbarians from catching you off guard with a sudden attack. I am Alexander the Macedonian." With that he said this and rode back, returning to the camp and taking up his own post again. The Athenian generals went to the right wing and told Pausanias what they had heard from Alexander. He, made fearful of the Persians by this report, said the following, "Since, then, the battle is to take place at dawn, you Athenians ought to stand opposite the Persians, and we opposite the Boeotians and those Greeks arrayed against you. For this reason, you know the Medes and their manner of fighting, from having fought them at Marathon, whereas we are inexperienced and unacquainted with these men. For none of the Spartans has had experience of the Medes, while we are experienced with the Boeotians and Thessalians. So it would be best for you to take up your arms and go to this wing, and for us to go to the left one." To this, the Athenians replied as follows, "We too, from the very start, ever since we saw the Persians drawn up opposite you, had it in mind to say this very thing which you have now proposed first, but we were afraid the proposal might not be welcome to you. Since, then, you yourselves have brought it up, we too are pleased by the proposal and are ready to do this." Since this pleased both parties, as dawn was breaking they exchanged positions. But the Boeotians, perceiving what was being done, reported it to Mardonius. He, upon hearing it, at once tried himself to shift his own troops, leading the Persians across to face the Lacedaemonians. When Pausanias learned that this was happening, realizing that he was not going unnoticed, led the Spartans back to the right wing, and Mardonius likewise did the same on his left. When they had been restored to their original positions, Mardonius dispatched a messenger to the Spartans, who delivered the following speech. "Lacedaemonians, you are indeed said by the people of this region to be the best of men, since they marvel that you neither flee from war nor abandon your post, but either destroy your enemies by standing firm or are destroyed yourselves. But none of this was true. For before we even came together and engaged hand to hand, we already saw you fleeing and abandoning your position, letting the Athenians make the first trial of us while you yourselves took up position against our slaves. These are in no way the deeds of brave men, and we have been altogether deceived in you. For we expected, on the strength of your reputation, that you would send a herald to us challenging and wishing to fight against the Persians alone, being ready to do this. Yet we found you saying nothing of the sort, but rather cowering. Now then, since you did not begin this proposal, we begin it. Why do you not, since you are reputed to be the best of the Greeks, fight on behalf of the Greeks against us, before the barbarians, we being equal in number to equal? And if it seems good that the others too should fight, let them fight afterward. But if it seems best that we alone should suffice, then let us fight it out, and whichever of us wins, let that side be reckoned as having won for the whole army. Having said this and having waited some time, since no one answered him anything, he withdrew back, and upon returning he reported to Mardonius what had happened. He, overjoyed and elated by this empty victory, sent his cavalry against the Greeks. When the horsemen had ridden up, they harassed the whole Greek army, hurling javelins and shooting arrows, since being mounted archers they were hard to come to grips with. And the spring called Gargaphia, from which the whole Greek army drew its water, they threw into confusion and choked up. Now the Lacedaemonians alone were stationed near the spring, but for the rest of the Greeks the spring was farther off, as each contingent happened to be positioned, while the Esopus was near. Yet being kept from the Esopus, they resorted to the spring for that reason, for they were not able to fetch water from the river because of the horsemen and their arrows. With this happening, the Greek generals, since the army was being deprived of water and thrown into disorder by the cavalry, gathered together concerning these matters and others, going to Pausanias at the right wing. For other things too, besides these, troubled them further. Food had by now run out entirely, and the men serving as their attendants who had been sent off to the Peloponnese to fetch food had been shut off from the camp by the cavalry, unable to make their way back. As the generals deliberated, it seemed best to them that, if the Persians should put off giving battle that day, they should withdraw to the island. This island is, from the Esopus and the spring of Gargaphia where they were then encamped, 10 stadia distant, in front of the city of the Plataeans. Such an island could exist on the mainland in this way. The river, splitting above from Cithaeron, flows down into the plain, its two streams separated from each other by about 3 stadia, and then they join together again into one. Its name is Iro. The local people say she is a daughter of Esopus. It was to this place, then, that they resolved to move, so that they might have water in abundance and the cavalry might not harass them, as they were doing while positioned directly opposite. They decided to shift their position then, when it should be the second watch of the night, so that the Persians would not see them setting out, and so that the cavalry, following them, would not throw them into disorder. When they had reached this place, the one where the Esopian Iro splits apart as it flows down from Cithaeron, during that same night, it was decided to send off half of the army toward Cithaeron, so as to pick up the attendants who had gone for provisions, for these were cut off on Cithaeron. Having decided this, they endured a whole day of unrelenting toil, hemmed in by the pressing cavalry. Only when day gave way to evening and the horsemen ceased did night come on, and when it was the hour at which they had agreed to withdraw, then most of them, once they had roused themselves, set out, not with the intention of going to the place agreed upon, but as soon as they were set in motion, they fled gladly from the cavalry toward the city of the Plataeans, and in their flight they arrived at the Herion. This lies in front of the city of the Plataeans, 20 stadia distant from the spring of Gargaphia, and having arrived they set down their arms before the sanctuary. And they encamped around the Herion, while Pausanias, seeing them leaving the camp, ordered the Lacedaemonians too to take up their arms and follow after those already advancing, supposing that they were going to the place they had agreed upon. Then the rest of the captains of companies were ready to obey Pausanias, but Amphiaradus, son of Polyades, the leader of the Pitonate company, insisted he would never run from foreigners, nor would he willingly bring shame upon Sparta, and he marveled, seeing what was being done, since he had not been present at the earlier discussion. Pausanias and Euryanax thought it a terrible thing that he would not obey them, but thought it still more terrible, since he refused to comply, to abandon the Pitonate company, lest, if they abandoned it while carrying out what had been agreed with the rest of the Greeks, Amphiaradus himself, and those with him, being left behind, should perish. Reasoning thus, they kept the Laconian army still, and tried to convince him that doing this would not be right. And so they tried to talk over Amphiaradus, who alone of the Lacedaemonians and Tegeans had been left behind, while the Athenians did the following. They kept themselves still where they had been posted, knowing the temper of the Lacedaemonians, that they thought one thing and said another. When the army began moving, they dispatched a rider to observe whether the Spartans intended to march out, or whether they had no thought at all of leaving, and to ask Pausanias what he meant to do. When the herald arrived among the Lacedaemonians, he found them still drawn up in their places, and their leading men engaged in a quarrel. For when Euryanax and Pausanias were trying to persuade Amompharetus not to endanger himself by remaining behind alone with his men, cut off from the rest of the Lacedaemonians, they could not persuade him at all, until finally they fell into open dispute, just as the Athenian herald arrived and stood beside them. In the course of the quarrel, Amompharetus took up a stone in both hands, and setting it down before the feet of Pausanias, said that with this pebble he cast his vote not to flee from the strangers, meaning by this the barbarians. Pausanias called him a madman out of his senses, and turning to the Athenian herald, who was asking what he should report, told him to describe the situation as it stood, and asked the Athenians to come over to the Lacedaemonian side and do, regarding the withdrawal, whatever they themselves did. So the herald went off to the Athenians. Meanwhile, as the Lacedaemonians spent the time disputing among themselves, dawn overtook them, and at that point Pausanias, since he did not believe Amompharetus would be willing to be left behind when the rest of the Lacedaemonians departed, which is exactly what happened, gave the signal and led the rest of the army away through the hills, and the Tegeans followed with them. The Athenians, for their part, having been posted separately, marched the opposite way from the Lacedaemonians. For the Lacedaemonians kept close to the hills and the foothills of Cithaeron, out of fear of the cavalry, while the Athenians turned down toward the plain. Amompharetus, who had never at all believed that Pausanias would dare to abandon his men, held his ground, insisting that they must not leave their position. But when Pausanias' troops had already gone some distance ahead, thinking that they were truly abandoning him, he took up his company and its arms and led them at a walk toward the main body. That body, having gone about 10 stads, waited for Amompharetus' company, halting by the river Maloes, at a place called Argiopium, where there also stands a temple of Eleusinian Demeter. They waited there for this reason, so that, if Amompharetus and his company did not leave the position where they had been stationed but remained there, they might go back and help them. And indeed Amompharetus' men caught up with them just as the enemy's cavalry, in full force, fell upon them. For the horsemen were doing what they always did. Seeing the place empty where the Greeks had been posted on the previous days, they kept riding their horses ever forward, and as soon as they overtook the Greeks, they pressed hard upon them. When Mardonius learned that the Greeks had gone off during the night and saw the place deserted, he called for Thorax of Larissa and his brothers Eurypylus and Thrasydeus and said, "Sons of Aluas, now that you see this place empty, what will you say? You who live nearby used to tell me that the Lacedaemonians never flee from battle, but are the foremost of men in war, the very men you saw leaving their positions before, and now again, during the night just past, all of us see they have run away. They have shown, now that they were about to be tested in battle against men who are truly the best in the world, that they are nobodies, standing among Greeks who are themselves nobodies. And as for you, who have had no experience of Persians, I could readily forgive you for praising these men, since you knew something of them yourselves. But I was far more astonished that Artabazus should be so afraid of the Lacedaemonians, and being afraid, should put forward so cowardly a proposal, that we should break camp and go to besiege the city of the Thebans. The king shall yet hear of this from me, but that matter shall be discussed elsewhere. For now, we must not let these men do as they are doing. We must pursue them until they are overtaken, and pay us the penalty for all that the Persians have suffered." Having said this, he led the Persians at a run across the Asopus, following the Greeks' tracks, as though they were indeed fleeing, and directed his pursuit against the Lacedaemonians and Tegeans alone, for he could not see the Athenians, who had turned down into the plain, hidden by the hills. When the other commanders of the barbarian units saw the Persians setting out in pursuit of the Greeks, they all at once raised their signals, and pursued as fast as each man's feet could carry him, with neither order nor formation. They came on with shouting and a great rush, as though they would sweep the Greeks away entirely. But Pausanias, when the cavalry pressed upon him, sent a horseman to the Athenians with this message: "Men of Athens, since the greatest of struggles now lies before us, whether Greece is to be free or enslaved, we have been betrayed by our allies, both we Lacedaemonians and you Athenians, since during the night just past they ran away. Now then, it has been decided what we must do from here on. We must defend ourselves as best we can and shield one another. If the cavalry had turned against you first, it would have been right for us, together with the Tegeans, who have not betrayed Greece, to come to your aid. But as it is, since the whole force has advanced against us, the just course is for you to go to the aid of that part which is pressed hardest. But if something has happened to make it impossible for you yourselves to come to our aid, then do us this favor: send us your archers. We know that throughout this present war you have shown the greatest zeal of all, so that you will surely listen to this request too." When the Athenians heard this, they set out at once to help and to give aid as best they could. But as they were already on the march, the Greeks who had taken the king's side and were stationed opposite them attacked, so that they could no longer bring help, since the enemy pressing upon them gave them no relief. So the Lacedaemonians and Tegeans, left to fight alone, together with their light-armed troops numbering 50,000, the Lacedaemonians and 3,000 Tegeans, for these never separated themselves from the Lacedaemonians, began to offer sacrifice, since they were about to engage Mardonius and the army before them. But since the sacrifices were not turning out favorable, in the meantime many of them were falling and far more were being wounded. For the Persians, having set up a barrier of their wicker shields, shot off a great many arrows without restraint, so that as the Spartans were being hard-pressed and the sacrifices still would not come out right, Pausanias looked toward the temple of Hera at Plataea and called upon the goddess, begging that they should in no way be cheated of their hope. While he was still calling upon her, the Tegeans rose up first and advanced against the barbarians, and immediately after Pausanias' prayer the sacrifices, as the Lacedaemonians offered them, turned out favorable. So then, when the time at last came, they too advanced against the Persians, and the Persians met them, setting aside their bows. The fighting began first around the wicker shields. When these had fallen, the battle grew fierce right by the temple of Demeter itself, and lasted a long time, until at last it came to close combat, for the barbarians would seize hold of the spears and break them. In courage and strength the Persians were not inferior, but being unarmored and moreover unskilled and no match for their opponents in tactical skill, they would dash forward singly or in tens, in larger or smaller groups, and fall upon the Spartans, and so be destroyed. Now in the place where Mardonius himself happened to be, fighting on a white horse, and having around him a picked band of the 1,000 best Persians, there they pressed hardest upon their opponents. As long as Mardonius lived, the Persians held their ground and, defending themselves, cut down many of the Lacedaemonians. But when Mardonius was killed, and the unit stationed around him, which was the strongest, fell as well, then indeed the rest turned and gave way before the Lacedaemonians. For what harmed them most was that they wore no armor, being lightly clad, they fought a battle against hoplites. There the justice owed for Leonidas' death, according to the oracle, was paid to the Spartans by Mardonius, and Pausanias, son of Cleombrotus, son of Anaxandrides, won the fairest victory of all we know of. The names of his ancestors before him have already been given in the account of Leonidas, for they happen to be the same. Mardonius was killed by Eumnestus, a man of note in Sparta, who some time afterward, after the Persian Wars, engaging with 300 men at Stenacleris during the war against all the Messenians, was himself killed along with his 300. At Plataea, when the Persians were routed by the Lacedaemonians, they fled in complete disorder, making for their own camp and for the wooden stockade which they had built in the territory of Thebes. It is a marvel to me that, although the fighting took place right by the Grove of Demeter, not a single Persian was seen either to enter the sacred precinct or to die within it, while most of them fell around the sanctuary, on unconsecrated ground. I think, if one ought to hold any opinion about matters divine, that it was the goddess herself who would not let them in, since they had burned her sanctuary, the shrine at Eleusis. So far, then, went this battle. As for Artabazus, son of Pharnaces, he had been displeased from the start at Mardonius being left behind by the king, And now too, though he protested strongly against it, he accomplished nothing by trying to prevent the engagement. He himself, however, acted in a way that showed his displeasure with what Mardonius was doing. The forces Artabazus commanded, and he had no small force, but as many as 40,000 men under him. He led in an orderly manner, once the battle had begun, knowing well what the outcome would be, having instructed all of them beforehand to go together wherever he himself should lead, keeping their eyes on him and matching his pace. Having given these orders, he led his army forward as though toward the battle. But as he advanced along the way, he saw that the Persians were already in flight. And at that point, he no longer led them in the same order, but fled at full speed, heading neither for the wooden stockade nor for the wall of Thebes, but toward Phocis, wanting to reach the Hellespont as quickly as possible. So these men turned that way. But of the other Greeks who were with the king and were fighting half-heartedly, the Boeotians fought against the Athenians for a considerable time. For the Thebans who sided with the Medes showed no small eagerness, fighting and not shirking, so much so that 300 of their best and foremost men fell there at the hands of the Athenians. But when these two turned to flight, they made for Thebes, fleeing by a different route than the Persians and the whole crowd of the other allies, who fled without fighting it out with anyone or accomplishing anything. This shows me that the whole fortune of the barbarians hung upon the Persians, since even these men fled then before they had even engaged the enemy, simply because they saw the Persians retreating. So all fled, except the cavalry, both the rest and that of Boeotia. And this cavalry helped those fleeing greatly, since it stayed always closest to the enemy and shielded the friendly fugitives from the Greeks. The victors followed after Xerxes' men, pursuing and slaughtering them. In the midst of this rout, word was brought to the other Greeks who were stationed around the Harion and had taken no part in the battle, that a fight had already occurred and that Pausanias' men were winning. When they heard this, drawn up in no order at all, some, the Corinthian contingent, turned along the foothill road and the hills leading up straight to the temple of Demeter, while others, the Megarian and Phlyasian contingent, went through the plain by the smoothest of the roads. But when the Megarians and Phlyasians drew near the enemy, the Theban horsemen, seeing them advancing in no order, rode against them at a gallop. Their commander was Asopodorus, son of Timander, and falling upon them struck down 600 of them and drove the rest, pursuing them, back to Cithaeron. These men perished without anyone taking notice. But the Persians and the rest of the throng, when they had fled for refuge into the wooden stockade, managed to climb up onto the towers before the Lacedaemonians arrived, and once up they fortified the wall as well as they could. And when the Lacedaemonians came up, a fiercer battle for the wall broke out. For as long as the Athenians were absent, the defenders held out and had much the better of the Lacedaemonians, since the Lacedaemonians did not know how to attack walls. But when the Athenians came up, then indeed the fighting for the wall grew fierce and lasted a long time. At last, by valor and persistence, the Athenians mounted the wall and broke it down, and there the Greeks poured in. The Tegeans were the first to enter the wall, and it was they who plundered Mardonius' tent, taking from it, among other things, the manger of his horses, which was entirely of bronze and worth seeing. This manger of Mardonius, the Tegeans dedicated in the temple of Athena Aleia, while everything else they had taken they brought to the same place as the rest of the Greeks. The barbarians, once the wall had fallen, formed no body of resistance at all, nor did any of them think of defending himself. But they scurried about in a panic, crowded as they were in a small space, terrified, many tens of thousands of men penned in together. It was possible for the Greeks to slaughter them so freely that of an army of 300,000, less the 40,000 with whom Artabazus fled, not even 3,000 of the rest survived. Of the Lacedaemonians from Sparta, 91 in all died in the battle, of the Tegeans 16, of the Athenians 52. Of the barbarians, the most valiant were the Persian infantry, the Sacchi cavalry, and among individual men Mardonius is said to have been so. Of the Greeks, though the Tegeans and the Athenians proved good, the Lacedaemonians surpassed them in valor. I can point to no other proof of this except this, that all these contingents defeated the forces facing them, than that the Lacedaemonians engaged and overcame the strongest part of the enemy. And by far the bravest man, in my judgment, was Aristodemus, who alone of the 300 survived from Thermopylae and bore the reproach and disgrace of it. After him, the most valiant were Posidonius, Philician, and Amompharetus the Spartan. Yet when talk arose as to which of them had been best, the Spartans present judged that Aristodemus, wishing openly to die because of the charge then hanging over him, had raged forth from his post and performed great deeds, while Posidonius, not wishing to die, had shown himself a good man, and for that reason judged him the better of the two. But this they might say out of envy, for all those I have named, except Aristodemus, who died in this battle were held in honor, while Aristodemus, because he wished to die on account of the charge already mentioned, was not honored. These, then, were the most renowned of those at Plataea. As for Callicrates, he died outside the battle, having come the handsomest man in the camp of the Greeks of that time, not only among the Lacedaemonians themselves, but among all the other Greeks. As Pausanias was sacrificing, he, sitting in his rank, was wounded in the side by an arrow. And so while the others fought, he, carried off the field, was dying hard and said to Arimnestus, a man of Plataea, that it did not trouble him to die for Greece, but rather that he had not used his hand, and that he had no deed accomplished worthy of himself, though he had been eager to perform one. Of the Athenians, Sophanes son of Eutychides is said to have distinguished himself from the deme of Decelea, the Decelians who once did a deed useful for all time, as the Athenians themselves say.